So, hello everybody, and welcome to MoMA's Brown Bag Lecture Series. Well said? Doesn't feel like it's on. No, it's on. Great. So, again, welcome everybody, and thanks for coming in on this Thursday. And I hope that you get to go out again and enjoy the crisp but gorgeous November day afterwards, but I hope it's worth it for the trip to Paris, so to speak, in our lecture today. My name is Larissa Bailiff, and I'm a lecturer here and an instructor of MoMA courses. And my talk today is entitled Exhibiting Exoticism, the Universal Exposition of 1889 and the Art of Edward Munch, Paul Gauguin, and Henri Rousseau. And I've been asked to tell you to turn off your cell phones and also, unless it's an absolute burning curiosity emergency, for you to keep your questions to the end, and I'll try to save a couple of minutes for questions or comments, and feel free to add your insights. And I'm going to answer a question that I received on Monday when I gave this talk, and that is there an exhibition that's related to this? No. In fact, I picked the topic. The impetus is looking at a few of my favorite works in MoMA's collection, and right now, and I'll point out which works are on display, probably some of your favorites as well, but the Rousseau's on the fifth floor, the Gauguin's are out on loan. And we'll talk about a Munch that's probably well known to you. So, I came up with a way to organize these famous MoMA images through the lens of a World's Fair that was very important during its time and continues, I think, to have repercussions. Come on in. So, actually, we're looking at a photograph here, and I'll show you many photographs and images. The first part of the talk will comprise actually sort of a touristic gaze upon some of the things you would have seen or experienced had you gone to the World's Fair in 1889. By the way, the World's Fair started, I believe, in 1798, and they happened every 11 years. So this was something that had been going on for quite a while. The point was to show off sort of progress with this notion of the positive notion of progress, colonialism, etc. But by 1889, they had these fairs had become not just a way to sort of show off one's patrimony, but forms of entertainment, not just education and enlightenment. So what we're seeing here in this beginning photograph is some recreated African huts, if you will. And behind them we can see actually recreations, reconstructions of other habitations, if you will, as they were called there, from different cultures and time periods. And we'll extend that theme in just a minute, but you can see the Parisians or the tourists walking amongst these. By the way, the World's Fair took place over 6 months, so it started on May 6th, 1889, and ran through November 6th, its final day in 1889. And it had 28 million visitors. It covered 237 acres, so this was a huge spectacle. Just to orient ourselves, here is a map of the World's Fair, and you can see the Eiffel Tower, which was erected specifically for display and its opening at the World's Fair. In fact, the elevators weren't installed properly at this point. You could get up to the second floor using stairs, but I mean, everything was right down to the wire for the World's Fair, like many events that we hear about now where, you know, people are struggling to get things ready for the Olympics, etc. And you can see, laser pointer here, names that you might be familiar with, the Trocadero. Now, many of us have been to the Eiffel Tower, and again, it was brand new. And in fact, its fate was not determined at this point. It was going to last for 20 years, and this iron-framed new technology, and then perhaps be torn down. But fortunately, by about 1906, people had decided that it was worthy of remaining. I'm going to see if my laser pointer is working. No, I'm just going to point out things here. It is
pointing at you.
It is pointing at me. Thank you. I'm not up on the modern technology here. I had it down on Monday. All right. Is it still pointing at me? There we go. Okay. Thank you so much. So we see the Eiffel Tower there with the Champ de Mars. I'll show you a picture of the enormous Galerie de Machine, which was 111 meters long. It was the largest interior in a space in the world at this point, erected specifically for the World's Fair. You can see the Rue de Caire, or the Street of Cairo, right there. Around the Eiffel Tower were 44 reconstructions of, again, habitations or buildings. This was designed or overseen by Charles Garnier, who designed the Parisian Opera House, and he was in charge of making sure that an Egyptian building looked Egyptian or was a recreation of, say, a pyramid or a temple, etc., that African huts look like African huts. So we can even think about sort of this colonialist notion of bringing the other in a very exciting and exotic way, sometimes dramatizing or exaggerating certain features and characteristics. There was also a notion of periods throughout history. So one could go into ancient caves in this area here and travel all the way on up through contemporary world. The French colonies were located over here, so the French were celebrating their newest colonies through, again, habitations, huts, and in fact there were people from a number of these different cultures who were brought and lived on site for that six-month period. And whatever our political notions are now, I think very different than the notions of display then. But that's one of the features that I want to continue to talk about when we begin to see how our artists are exposed to this and interested in it and how they bring that into the modern realm of art making. Some postcards, again, featuring that grand Eiffel Tower, 1,000 feet up in the air, and an absolute symbol of the newest technology. And again, almost not to be built. There was a lot of fighting and a lot of anger, even after it was built, that it was just too new a symbol and not beautiful enough. But we have that sort of juxtaposition of the absolutely modern and ancient and exotic cultures there, which we see in this photograph here. And I'm just going to read one travelogue description who described the experience of the picturesque encampments that I'm discussing here, these recreations of different cultures and time periods. As one observer noted, it was like a magical carpet. This carpet, a simple ticket of entrance, is the talisman that admits them to the country of dreams. Here you are transported according to your caprice, from Cairo to the Americas, from the Congo to Cochin China, from Tunisia to Java, from Annam to Algeria, and so forth. And all of the travelogues, and there were many, and the newspapers discussed this. And of course, it didn't extend just to the encampments or seeing these, you know, quote-unquote, indigenous peoples there. They were selling wares, they were producing music, and selling foodstuffs. So one can imagine the sights, the sounds, the sensations, the smells, etc. And the overlapping, which we see here, building against building against building. If you were wondering how you got around, and this was in the first map that we saw there, there was a sort of slightly miniature scale train that had been created for the World's Fair to get you around those 237 acres. And it might call up in your mind things like Disneyland and their sort of tram. And it was somewhat of that sort of spectacle experience and the notion that you could sort of be in the small world and experience all of these things that you would never experience if you never made it outside of Paris. Here, a hand-tinted, just gorgeous photograph of the Rue de Caire, which we saw along the road there near the Eiffel Tower. And I just wanted to mention how important this was in the minds, the sort of mentalité, the imagination of visitors who came. They all write about this and discuss it in their diaries and their letters. And Edmond de Goncourt, one of the writers of the time, discusses going back to the Rue de Cairo again and again and again as one of his frequent spots. And you could, you know, sort of hang out in the Casbah or recreation. You would go to the cafes. You would see the belly dancers, and belly dancing just sort of captivated everyone's imagination. At the same time that back in Egypt, it was sort of going into decline. It was being celebrated in Paris as something quite open and public. But that's a whole nother topic. But again, we can see the Parisians and the other European tourists sort of flocking through the streets and experiencing the exotic firsthand. The Galerie de Machine, and I showed you where it was on the map, this huge enclosed space. And I think overall in the entire exposition of 1889, there were 60,000 exhibits, but certainly many of those were in the Galerie de Machine. The most famous was a setup, a very large area devoted to Monsieur Thomas Edison, whose name probably rings a bell or a telephone. Can you see it right there?
Yes, the red to the right of center.
Great. I'm going to try to work my technology again. Have I turned it around? Still not used to this. Edison. I'm gonna point to it. So you're saying?
Yeah.
Right there. So prominent place even in this postcard here, and he was displaying his newfangled phonographs. Later on, he would do the nickel sort of movie projectors. But right now, he had come to Paris to celebrate and to show off. And he was very adamant that he didn't want to charge, like some of his business partners did, but for people to use the phonographs. And he did lots of recordings while he was in Paris of many different people. Another famous American who had come to Paris during this time was Buffalo Bill. Colonel William Cody, and we see the promotional poster there that was pasted all over Paris with him, you know, ensconced on a buffalo there, and then we see some of his band of Indians, as they were called, that he brought over with him to Paris, and they were quite celebrated. Whom I don't have a photograph of is Annie Oakley, and in fact, the French loved her even more than they loved her colleague, Wild Bill, the sharpshooter Annie Oakley, Wild Bill Cody even posed for Rosa Bonheur, and that became part of the posters as well. And that notion of the sort of Western sensibility or ethos and undramatization and theatricalization fantasy of the Wild Wild West becomes just one more form of the exotic that's on display at this time. But probably the thing that people referred to most was the Javanese dancers. So I have a photograph here, and we'll return to this when we think about Gauguin in particular. But apparently they were incredibly graceful and stunning and just really captivated, again, the sort of imagination of artists and writers. And the musicians who performed with the Javanese dancers, or you can see it the other way around, but the musicians had such an impact on visitors as well, including the composer Claude Debussy, who goes on to sort of influence what we would call ambient music of Sun Ra, John Cage, etc. He is so influenced by the Javanese gamelan tradition that he experiences here. So again, enormous impact on modernism through the exotic. A lot of art was shown at the World's Fair, and of course that's our topic, sort of thinking about the impact on three artists in particular. One of them, actually two, were showing at the World's Fair. Gauguin wasn't accepted into the official exhibition for French painters, and so he thumbed his nose at officialdom and in fact set up camp, not in a pavilion like his predecessors Manet and Courbet had done in former expositions, but he was able to wrangle a cafe right across the space from the official French pavilion. So, you know, many of the countries had had official exhibitions set up, and we'll talk about Munch actually showed at the Norwegian pavilion. But Gauguin decided to hold his own sort of exhibition de refusé, if you will. And here is the poster for that. Which was held at the Café des Arts. It was more a matter of luck than anything else that he got to actually be on the grounds of the World Fair and to even have a show. It turned out that a certain Monsieur Volpini, and that becomes the name of the exhibition, the Volpini exhibition, had a restaurant, and the mirrors that he wanted to place all around the restaurants hadn't come in, and it was approaching May, and just like everything else, nothing was going to be ready. And so Gauguin, or his friend Schuffenecker, approached Monsieur Volpini and said, "Look, have I got a deal for you? Have I got an idea? You can put all of our paintings on, you know, where the mirrors would be. You should paint everything bright red and exhibit it sort of salon style, and you'll have this beautiful decoration, and you're set." And Volpini bought it, and the exhibition was held, and it was important for Gauguin and Emile Bernard, another artist names you can see on the list there, to show their new brand of modernism. And you can see that it says Groupe Impressionniste et Synthétiste. Gauguin would go on to call himself a synthetist or a synthetist, and this idea of bringing together many exotic forms, bold colors, a lot taken from Japanese woodblock tradition, flattened forms, etc. So this was put on display, not officially, but at the World's Fair. And just to show you a couple of things that were shown there, These are works by Gauguin. He showed a number of prints. They're called zincographs because they're done, we were just talking about prints earlier, but these are done on metal zinc plates. But you can see he was drawn towards this bright yellow paper. He showed about 11 of those on that bright paper. Here is a woman in the waves, very sort of dislocated, beautiful, interesting modern cropping and bright colors. Bold stylized forms. These are Breton girls, again, the sort of ambiguous figure, female figure in the waves. Another artist who showed there was Gauguin's friend Emile Bernard, and we have two works here. And one of the works is in MoMA's collection, although not on display right now. That is the Iron Bridge at Asnières. This is not in our collection, but both exhibit, again, the stylization, the simplification. Here we have the dark silhouettes, these bold forms, drawing very much on Japanese woodblocks for the abandonment of traditional perspective. And we also have these dark outlines, which are drawn from the medieval tradition. So already sort of culling and layering from different sources. Van Gogh was supposed to show at the show, and then Vincent and his brother Theo said, you know what, it seems a little risky, I'm not quite sure what they're doing. Even though Theo was Gauguin's dealer, he said, why don't you hold off and not show with these guys at the show? The show was a failure, so Theo was probably right. That is to say, nobody bought anything, and Gauguin writes about it as being a miserable failure. Here's the catalog that went with it, and we can see on it, Champ de Mars, it's stamped 1889 from the exposition. And this is where we get to our first artist. It was seen by a number of young artists and writers, and it was important for them and very, very formative. And one of those artists was Edvard Munch. Now, Edvard Munch, known for works like The Scream, and here is a lithograph form of the famous Scream, and in a minute we'll see a slide representation of the painting that you're probably more familiar with in its bright colors. But we associate Munch with expressionism and bold subject matter, often delving into the psyche, and this is not how he painted when he came to Paris in 1889. He came to study there on a fellowship and exposed himself to the things that he saw at the exposition. And certainly he was at the Café des Arts or Café Volpini looking at Gauguin's work. I mentioned previously that Munch also had another reason for being there. He was showing at least a couple of works, this work included, at the Norwegian Pavilion. So he was representing his country and homeland in what we would consider a fairly up-to-date, modern, impressionist-type style. We see this woman in a domestic space, this young woman. Not, though, what we tend to associate Munch's painting with. So we'll look at just a couple of things that he does, but I've brought in, for sake of comparison, a work by Anquetin, a French artist that we know showed at that small Volpini restaurant exhibition on the grounds of the fair, and a Munch next to it, Evening on Karl Johann Strasse of 1892, the same year in which he undertakes The Scream. And we can see radical changes in terms of Munch's style and perhaps akin to Anquetin in terms of some of the sharp cropping, certainly the bold colors, the sort of hustle and bustle, the anonymity, and an expressionist quality to things. And again, any of the works we're looking at today could, take up a whole brown bag lecture talk, but we're going to sort of give it that touristic gaze of sort of looking at things very, very quickly, as we would if we were at the World's Fair. So here's the Munch that we know and love, right? In the famous Scream, of which there are four versions and, again, some later lithographs. It's expressionistic colors and sense of evocation, emotion. I'm going to tell you what he says about it, what he writes about it. He describes the scene. I was walking along a path with two friends. The sun was setting. Suddenly the sky turned blood red. I paused, feeling exhausted, and leaned on the fence. There was blood and the tongues of fire above the blue-black fjord and the city. My friends walked on and I stood there trembling with anxiety, and I sensed an infinite scream passing through nature. So we're definitely into a different realm than a young woman in a domestic space in all senses. And we'll continue to look at this work, but I want to relate it to what Gauguin is doing and what Munch has seen at the exposition in Paris during this time. So this is a work not in MoMA's collection and not actually at the exposition, but Munch would have been familiar with it, this very famous vision after the sermon here. And I can't, laser pointer won't show up too much because it's red on red. But we have this amazing bold red background, which is the floor and the ceiling, so to speak. And if it reminds you of Matisse's Red Studio, I think he was familiar with this, that from 1911. But here we have ostensibly women who have come out of, Breton women in their caps, who have come out of a sermon, and they're experiencing a type of vision, an inward vision, or they're sort of thinking about the story that they've just heard of Jacob wrestling the angel. But that doesn't account for everything. Or let's just say this is the antithesis of what the Impressionists had done in trying to capture what they considered objectivity or the real world. This is about a very interior vision that we are privy to, whether it's ours or theirs. Most of us don't go around seeing angels wrestling. As Courbet once said, I never see an angel, so I'm not going to paint one. But Gauguin said, dig inside, look at your dreams, and think about those things. Now, Gauguin is looking at other things as well, the medieval tradition, which gives him what he calls cloisonnesme, that dark outlining. He's again looking at Japanese woodblock prints for the bold colors, the lack of depth, what that cow is doing up there, sort of floating around, that's what this is. This actually comes out of a Japanese woodblock print of a plum tree. We see it appear in Van Gogh's work as well. So again, not what he sees outside, but what he's internalized or what he's derived or poached or compiled from other works of art, but all alive in these fabulous jewel tones, absolutely stylized. And I think that, you know, Munch is thinking about these bright, intense colors and pushing coloration as well as, you know, line and form. And of course, Munch's perspective is absolutely dynamic and terrifying with the jutting back of that bridge on that fjord, even the way the fjords themselves play off against the angularity. Now, what I'm showing you here is an earlier version that he does called Despair. Now, in either one, he's talking about anxiety, despair, the scream. There's a lot of angst. And this is brand new for modern art, for artists to begin in the 1890s to manifest their own inner psyches or the psyche of figures and to sort of put this into paint and form and to exaggerate it and pull it out. But when he starts with this, it is a slightly more, I hope you agree, naturalistic image. The figure is turned in profile. We're supposed to identify and sort of think about our identification with this figure who represents Munch himself. Okay. But then Munch alters it, turns the figure to face us and makes it even more radical. This, the hat, we can recognize this is contemporary life, you know, if dramatized. But this, something very strange is going on. And by the way, Munch had suffered a failed love affair not too long before this. So his angst and anxiety, which is meant to represent sort of universal angst, also relates to sort of personal issue of a very dramatic and upsetting breakup. And part of what he goes on to say about not just, you know, walking along and feeling the scream well up is that he says, I will never love again. Just to add another layer. But I'm going to throw in a Gauguin here, which was probably visible at that exposition, and certainly painted during the same year, and on that bright yellow we saw the prints, a very strange image, this Eve, don't listen to the liars. And Gauguin is often sort of weaving in notions of the primitive and Christianity in these strange symbolic images. And here too we see the sort of loud screaming colors, we see the sort of rhyming of serpent and strange undulating form. But what you're probably all staring at is not Eve, but rather this figure here, which was the source for Gauguin's Eve. And it is this 15th century Peruvian mummy that was on display at the Musée de l'Homme in Paris. And probably at the exposition, though I'm not sure, and scholars argue about this, but Munch could have seen it. Certainly Gauguin saw it when he was in Paris. Munch would have seen it either at the Musée de l'Homme or the exposition. But then Munch also would have seen and known that Gauguin had referenced that in a lot of images, both male and female, but particularly female, of this sort of crouching, miserable, you know, figures. And I say miserable because he often calls these images of misery. So you know, Gauguin is using this to represent the sort of inner psyche, the turmoil, and draws upon primitive art that would have been on display and available in 1889. So Munch turns to this when he revises his image, his self-portrait, if you will, and draws on that mummy, and that becomes that very famous sort of wild-looking face. And I want to turn to something that one of Munch's friends in Berlin stated about this and his coming back to Norway and Germany, both, and making this expressionist art. In fact, he made a bigger splash in Germany than he did in Norway. His friend said, he need not make his way, that is Munch, to Tahiti to see and experience the primitive in human nature. He carries his own Tahiti within him. So this equation of Tahiti or the exotic with the primitive in human nature, I think, is very interesting. So it's as if you need to draw on the primitive to get inside oneself and to register this new sort of psyche. So to make modern art, you have to get in touch with the primitive, and sometimes that's a primitive within. We're going to turn to Paul Gauguin now. And again, we've already sort of thought a little bit about his work that he's been displaying and some of his pastiching of different cultures. And it certainly had an enormous impact on him. We know that he went back again and again and again, and he writes to Bernard when Bernard doesn't show up. You know, you miss the Javanese dancers. You really have to come see them. So he's not only showing there, but he's checking out all the exhibits, and he's also meeting models there to represent. And here we have him, just to go over his timeline really briefly, he does move to Tahiti, as we'll talk about in 1891, and he moves back to Paris, Gauguin does, in 1893 till 1895 to try to sell his works, and that's when this photograph was taken. What's he wearing in this? Does anybody recognize that? What kind of hat? It's a Stetson. So he actually got this idea from the Wild Bill show, and we, in fact, know that Munch visited the Wild Bill show as well, the Buffalo Bill show, and he writes to his father about it. But I have no information, no research has shown that Munch started wearing a Stetson, but Gauguin did. So there he is, photographed in his Stetson as a sort of part of his exotic persona there. He also, of course, as you might know, played up his Peruvian roots. He was something like 1/8 or 1/16 Peruvian through a grandfather, and always sort of talked about how Gauguin did, how he was more savage, in touch with his savage self, in quotes. Savage and Western, apparently. And in fact, he wore that when he showed up in Tahiti, and they thought, who's this man with really long hair and a Stetson hat? But on to Tahiti. In fact, Gauguin had considered other places, having been inspired by all the things that he'd seen at the World's Fair and read lots of pamphlets on the different French colonies. He at first considered Madagascar and Tonkin, and then finally settled on Tahiti. That was his third choice. And in fact, he intended to take Van Gogh with him if Van Gogh had recovered. So he finally makes his way there in search of paradise and also something cheaper. In some ways, he doesn't find either one. It wasn't quite the paradise that he thought he would find, and it wasn't cheaper for a while because he had to go to the Chinese grocer on the, you know, a mile away and buy canned tinned food. But finally, he made his way within the tropics. And, you know, even as he's sort of conceiving going to Tahiti, I wanted to share with you, he wrote to his friend Bernard a year after the exposition. He's still trying to figure out where to go. He says, "What I want to do is set up a studio in the tropics. With the money I shall have, I can buy a hut of the kind you saw at the Universal Exposition. An affair of wood and clay, thatched near town, but in the country." Right? So it's he's under the spell. He's, you know, he's done drawings. He's looked at everything. He's brought with him photographs from the World's Fair. He's even found apparently there was a recreated sculpture and a chunk of it fell off and he collected it and saved it almost sort of as a talisman. And he still referred to the Hindu dancers, the Javanese dancers, you know, calling them Hindu. So he gets to Tahiti and again, it is an exotic place, very different to Parisian eyes, but informed by novels that he's been reading by, you know, sailors over the last 100 years and thinking about sort of colonialist notions of things. He paints this painting, which is in MoMA's collection, not on display right now, but it will come back from loan. It's painted on burlap, by the way, which really plays up, and it's best seen in person, but it plays up the sort of coarseness and roughness, the idea that he's moving towards something primitive or exotic. And it's definitely meant to be an affront to the Western tradition of the idealized female nude. It's a picture of his lover at the time, Teomana. She's about 13 or 14 years old. And again, we could go into a lot more about Gauguin, but I want to say, he had her pose, and he had her pose as, and the title is The Seeds of the Eroi. He is representing her in a very mythological way as the woman who begat the Polynesian race. So the Eroi were the secret, sect and originary race of the Polynesians, at least according to him. Somewhat embellished mythology, no little hubris to paint your girlfriend as the begatter of the race. But there she is. But it's not exotic enough. Well, let me show you a photograph first. What I should say about Tahiti is that when he gets there, a lot of the population has been wiped out by disease. It has been entirely colonized. Pretty much everybody is Christian. A lot of the myths have been forgotten, so he does have to embellish some of those myths, make them up. People are dressed in what we call Mother Hubbards, the women are. So most of them are not running around naked in pareos. A lot of that is sort of shot for tourism, and when we see it in photographs, it's staged. Not always, but so what we see in this painting here is, what people would have worn, and then in the photograph here of the indigenous people making hats. I say that because here Teomana is, fully nude, taking up that art historical genre, the pareo around her with its wonderful sort of decorative elements. And the landscape, of course, is and is not what he would have seen. He's hyper-stylized it and punched the colors and flattened it out, playing up, its exoticism, its paradisical quality, and its sort of symbolist associations with form and music, etc. But I want you to take a close look at the pose, and if any of you are struck by that, the sort of arrangement of the body, not just her stunning beauty, there are sources for this that come straight out of the exposition. And this is what Gauguin is going to do in all of his Tahitian pictures. It's not enough that Tahiti is exotic and that these are brown nudes and different and other. He layers them with things that he's seen and things that he brings with them, including photographs from the World's Fair. So the Javanese, or Hindu dancers, as he calls them, provide a source for the gestures or the mudras, the poses, the sort of both awkward and elegant hands there, which are in the back of Gauguin's mind, but he literally carries photographs with him. We also know that he was very interested in Javanese figures from different sculptural reliefs from the Temple of Borobudur. He would have seen recreations of this at the exposition, and he even had photographs. Now, this is not the same pose that we see in The Seeds of the Eroi, but, some of the mudras all throughout, the gestures, the overlapping, and the stilted quality comes from this relief. And if you were sort of thinking about the stilted quality of the almost profile seated pose, a lot of that comes out of Egyptian wall painting. Again, he would have seen it at the exposition. We also know that he had a photograph of a relief that would have been in the London Museum, the National Gallery. So he was interested in sculpture, painting, and culling from these different techniques, poses, gestures. And then bringing that, overlaying it on top of a burlap canvas painted image of Teomana steeped in, exotic mythology. Now, I mentioned before that he's very interested in Christian associations as well. So we might see in that pose not just relation to the Temple of Borobudur, but her holding out a piece of fruit. Now it's a bit purplish, it doesn't look quite like our apples, but it is a reference to Eve. So he wants to overlay it even more, and that becomes a part of Gauguin's modernism, both an affront to what would have been seen in Paris, but this idea of overlaying meaning association. Some people might say poaching from different cultures. But it's akin to the sort of gaze we might have in surveying, everything we would see at the World's Fair in 1889 or for many of the World's Fairs. And finally, Rousseau. So Henri Rousseau, here we see a self-portrait. We feel like we're perhaps out of the realm of the exotic. But believe you me, Henri Rousseau was visiting the World's Fair almost every day. He was so entranced by it that he writes a vaudeville play. Fortunately, he didn't give up his day job. Ba-dum-bum. Well, actually, he did in 1893. He was a toll collector, but then he gave that up to paint full time. But he was painting every Sunday and visiting places, and he was going to the World's Fair. And so His play was never produced. It was called A Visit to the Exposition in 1889, in three acts. But he was there studying, sketching, being inspired. And we might even see... I'm not friends with this laser pointer. But right behind that boat on the Seine there, the Eiffel Tower. And most artists were too, this sounds silly, but too scared to represent modernity in that way. They didn't, you know, weren't sure how they felt about the Eiffel Tower. Maybe it was going to be torn down. They don't, it doesn't appear in most images until this point, or I should say afterwards, until, say, Delaunay's Eiffel Tower series. Georges Seurat paints a picture of it. But Rousseau defiantly puts it in there. I'm a modern painter of Paris, of the Seine, of the World's Fair, and he does this the year afterwards, shows himself as an artist in his beret and palette there in the center in his wonderful Myself portrait landscape. But let's move on. I'm actually going to pass this, but it's to suggest that his earlier works are genre scenes that are not impacted by the notions of the exotic. It is not until the World's Fair and afterwards, in 1889, that Rousseau turns towards exotic themes, jungle themes. And he paints about 25 jungle pictures in his lifetime, but they all happen after his visit to the World's Fair. So we have two in our collection, or at least two on display, and I hope that some of you will go upstairs and look at them more closely, so much better than in PowerPoint. But we have The Sleeping Gypsy, and in a few minutes we'll talk about The Dream. But this wonderful and very large-scale, ambitious work, again, comes out of the notion of representing the exoticism of other cultures. And in Rousseau's hands, they're very much a pastiche, a sort of bringing together of cultures, places, you know, of which France was obsessed in its time of colonial expansion. He calls this La Négresse. So is she from Africa? Where is she? We don't really know where we are. And, you know, the scene itself is fairly inexplicable. It's this wonderful, charming, with a sort of face in the moon, and this gypsy figure, this wandering figure with her lute, having fallen asleep, and the lion approaching her. So he never left. It's important to say he never left Paris. That is Rousseau, the artist. He was an armchair Orientalist, as we would call him. So this is all from imagination or things that he culls around him. And one of the things that he did was go to the Jardin des Plantes on a regular basis, as artists had been doing for the entire 19th century, as Barret had done and Delacroix had done, although, you know, Delacroix at least traveled to the Near East. But you could go, as we see the students doing here in 1902, drawing from the animals in the cages, and you could see exotic flora and fauna of all different types. So he certainly was a part of that. But if he didn't want to go in and sketch the real animals, he could actually, and he did, borrow the lion, which seems so oddly sort of docile, from a sculpture that is located at the Jardin des Plantes. I don't know if one can still visit. I would assume so. But it's actually a mid-19th century sculpture of a lion sniffing a corpse. But he turns it into this charming pastiche of a lion and a sleeping gypsy. Totally incongruous, wonderful sort of dreamlike quality. And very stylized, very modern, again, in its bold forms and its naivete, but also the mixing of associations and story. But let's turn briefly and lastly to Rousseau's very famous The Dream, his culminating jungle work, the last one he did in his lifetime. And by the way, if you're thinking about the Jungle Book as a source, in fact, Kipling had won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1907. So it was on people's minds at this time. He'd written it in 1894. So this is a huge work, again, up on our fifth floor, the last one that Rousseau did. And he, again, gives us an incongruous scene, which is a sort of pastiche of many different things. And again, we know that Rousseau looked at all kinds of sources. He didn't care if it was a postcard like the ones I showed you of the World's Fair, high art, or the art of Delacroix, the things he was seeing at the Jardin des Plantes. And one of his favorite elements of the Jardin des Plantes were the hothouses, which you can still go to today. So here, for instance, is the Mexican hothouse. And if you go inside, you can find, and actually this is an interior of a different hothouse, but gives you the effect of the different exotic plants, which he then sketched and studied. But of course, his plants, and this is just a detail of part of the snake charmer, his plants are, again, a melange of different effects and different plants. And some of the sources he's drawing on are, for instance, art, these stylized Egyptian images. And again, a lot of his animals and plants are shown in profile, very much drawing on that sort of Egyptian tradition. he does flatten and stylize almost every aspect of his work. And again, the animals sort of docile or staring, strange. I mean, it's a wonderful image to play a sense of cache-cache or, you know, hide and seek, as the French would say. But of course, we have to sort of come to terms with this Jadwiga figure here. Her name is Jadwiga. He says that it was a Polish model and lover of his that, you know, he's remembering. But he says in a little poem that it is her dream. So if you're wondering what has brought all of this about, she's lying on the settee. Of course, it's a man's dream of a woman's dream. She's naked. But it's her dream of the sort of fantastical scene. So fantastical, one of the sources that he might be sort of thinking about and alluding to is Georges Méliès, the early filmmaker. And this is just a film still from The Brahmin and the Butterfly. But this sort of dense foliage, the sort of fantastical imagery here and connection of woman and nature. But that's sort of a jarring juxtaposition there. But I wanted to show you another source, which is he was visiting the Museum National d'Histoire Naturelle, as well as at the Jardin des Plantes. They also had, and still have, a number of taxidermied animals. And one thing that I think a really smart, insightful scholar brought up is the fact that not only are Rousseau's, a lot of his animals sort of in profile, but they're very, very still. And the notion that if he's drawing from sources that are actually, well, dead and still, and he's studying them that way, I think that sort of translates over. He may even be trying to sort of show us that that's one of the sources that he's drawing on. So to wrap up with Rousseau, he's certainly thinking about modern art that's come in the last decades. He's contemporary with Munch and with Gauguin, thinking about Gauguin's exoticism. By this point, by the way, Gauguin has passed on, and Gauguin's sense of pastiche and exoticism is spreading all throughout Paris and being disseminated after his death in a number of retrospectives. So that's another source for Rousseau to be thinking about. But Rousseau is bringing together these wonderful dream-like experiences, which draw on lots of different exotic sources, both art and one might say real life, in the form of, say, hothouses and animals that he can see, but are not part of the Parisian, typical milieu. But he combines them together in a form of collage, painted nonetheless. But this is 1910. This is before Picasso and Braque have even started sticking things together in that way. So it's as if he's giving a painted collage of different sources, which in itself is an incredibly sort of modern perspective, if you will. So it's time for me to wrap up. And I know that we've, just, again, taken a sort of touristic gaze through the exposition and through a few pieces of work by these three great artists. But I hope that it's given you a lens to sort of think about and look through to both their sort of achievements and some of the sources where this comes from. So thank you very much. And I'm happy to take questions, comments. Any questions? Don't be shy. I'm going to also just recommend a couple of books. If you are interested in this, and I'm just going to assume that you might be, I am so enthusiastic about this topic, but this is a book that I came upon. It's called Eiffel's Tower. And I recommend it to you if you're interested in this period in history. It's not just about Eiffel's Tower. It's about the exposition. It's about Buffalo Bill and Annie Oakley, and so much. So it's really, really interesting. I'll leave that here if you want to take a look at it, and I'm giving it to you, Alan, if you haven't read it. Another one of my favorite books, it's not about the exposition, but if you're a fin de siècle lover or someone who wants to get interested in it, this is a very juicy book called Explosive Acts. Remember, this is sort of the moment of anarchy, at least in the 1890s, and it's all about Toulouse-Lautrec and Oscar Wilde. And if you like Rousseau and you didn't see a show that was held in about 2005, not at MoMA, but the National Gallery in Washington, come check out or get your hands on this book. It has beautiful illustrations of Rousseau's work and, again, talks about this time period and all of the different many sources that Rousseau is interested in. So I'm going to leave those there. This one is called Henri Rousseau, Jungles in Paris. And there was an exhibition that went with it, but it's really a fantastic read with lots of pictures. Yes?
Can you maybe give an example of, in literature, who was influenced? I know, for example, that Mikado was written because of the show, Japanese show in London. So I know that you know, it influenced music and influenced literature. But can you come with any example of somebody in literature that was kind of also kind of attractive?
It's a great question, and I'm going to turn it back at you and say, A, you answered it in part, the Mikado, and B, I'm going to say I don't, and it's something I would like to look more into.
Well,
so,
you said Kipling.
Kipling, and but I'm not sure, you know, if yeah, I mean, he wrote his in 1894, so I don't know that he was specifically, but I think, I mean, it is part of sort of, I think, the zeitgeist, if you will, not just in France. I mean, obviously, America was holding its world fairs and trying to compete with France, and other countries also were sort of vying for these colonialist, almost, sort of exhibition possibilities. But it's something I would like to look more into, and I'm also happy if, as you said, you know, perhaps Kipling, I mean, he certainly was involved in notions of colonialist expansion and sort of discussion within literature. You know, so, and if any of you have ideas to throw out as answers, you know, I'd appreciate it, and I'm sure you would as well. But it is a great question that is part of this topic, and I wish I knew more about it.
No, because what came up when you were talking about influence and Eiffel Tower, I remember the Crystal Palace and how many people were writing about the Crystal Palace.
Yes.
It definitely came out later on in Dostoevsky.
Yes.
Reaction that instead of going to the bright future...
No, and I mean, and again, there are a lot of what you're sort of underlining is... the sort of rosy glow, which I've sort of cast over this, but obviously, and particularly in literature, I think that authors do pick up or use it as a form of critique of both colonialist expansion or colonialist display, or the notion or notions of progress and positivity. And of course, the what you're talking about is the London Fair of 1855 and what came out of that. And of course, you know, the Eiffel Tower. And, you know, the world's fairs that came after were meant to challenge and rival and supersede in some ways the Crystal Palace of 55. And certainly the Galerie de Machine was, and I'm talking art and architecture again, but was meant to sort of rival notions of the Crystal Palace. It certainly wasn't as beautiful, but again, it used bridge engineering to try to succeed in making the biggest interior, you know, in a space in the world at that point. But I mean, I'm glad that you've put me on the track of some more research and a larger topic. So I do appreciate that. And I need to, I think, wrap it up if there's one more question or...
I just want to ask about Monk.
Sure.
Since he wasn't in the French...
No, yes.
So was he bringing other things or, I mean, was he totally influenced by this or was he going back to some of his Scandinavian...
Oh, he was definitely, I mean, he was definitely carrying it back to Scandinavia and to Germany, where he made a big splash, actually in 1892, and it really led to the German secession and then the Austrian one. It was actually Munch's work, and it was on display for a week, and it was considered so scandalous and radical that it really shocked everybody, and there was a fight about it, and that led to you know, things happening in Germany. So you know, Munch is a sort of more nuanced and complex sort of figure in some ways,
more in
the expressionist vein, and certainly the way I'm sort of showing it in terms of pastiche and collage and all of that. But I don't want to suggest that he was nothing before he came to Paris, but he was a young man, and I think he was being formed. He comes and works in a Parisian studio, and he's exposed to this and talks about it, and he just says Van Gogh, Gauguin, Anquetin, others. I mean, he was so impacted by that, and the World's Fair, which I think, again, a lot of people were, just the notion of having all of that at your fingertips and thinking about it and processing it and seeing other cultures, whether or not it was packaged or, you know, colonialist or dramatized or whatever, it had a big impact and allowed him to sort of be liberated. Just like Japanese woodblock prints had liberated a whole generation of artists as well. But I think, you know, I think he certainly makes great contribution. I think his contributions are later and through works of an expressionist power, like The Scream. So it's not to say, you know, he's derivative or that he's just borrowing from Gauguin, but I think that releases him to sort of come into who he is. Yeah.
So.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Now I'm going to go search out my literature.